Continuing with Professor Ort on 7 September 78.
I had been interested in the Crab Nebula for some time and had written a paper with Mayall and Duivendak, the professor of Chinese languages in Leiden.
This was 1942, I think.
Much earlier, already during the war. And after the war, we continued this, and Duivendak in particular looked up several new sources after the war. But that was at the time, was the end of it. Except that I remained interested in the object, in the Crab Nebula itself, and the observations which Mr. Wolgraven did at the time when this polarization was discovered were not to discover the polarization, because neither of us had ever thought about the existence of polarization in the Crab Nebula at that time, but to see whether we could measure the expansion of the Crab Nebula by determining the total light intensity as accurately as possible. And
over a period of several years?
Over a period of several years, but this, when this polarization was discovered, it was just the beginning of it, so the first epoch, so to say, of measurement of the total brightness. Then, because I was interested in these observations, I joined him at the telescope in a very cold winter, it was.
And in the whole winter, you were only able to get a total of 12 nights. It sounds like a typical...
It was a very clear winter and very cold. And also, the city lights at that time were not too bad, so that one could make photometric measurements, even with an instrument in the center of the city, as this telescope was. But Wolgraven had the idea, well, why not measure polarization at the same time? And, well, we have this separator. He was a very good instrument man. And but then he found a very large polarization, and we became very much interested, because the polarization at once seemed to be larger than one could account for by interstellar scattering.
Right.
And that was the only thing at that time we could think of for getting polarization.
Mm-hmm. But now let me ask, in your paper you say it was decided to check the discovery by the Soviet astronomers of the polarization of the light. So you had heard about their results. And no, in fact, I believe you visited the Soviet Union.
Right, yes.
Can you tell me about that?
When I visited the Soviet Union, at what time? That was at the time of the dedication of the new Pulkovo Observatory, when for the first time a delegation of Western astronomers visited the Soviet Union.
I see.
And at that time I had several discussions with Shklovsky and Ginzburg, I believe, also. But at that time I did not know about the polarization results that they had found, and I understood only very incompletely what they were telling me. They had developed this idea of the synchrotron radiation to quite considerable extent.
Had you heard at all about this before you went to the Soviet Union, about synchrotron radiation?
No.
Not even the physical review articles by Alfvén and Herlovson?
No, I saw those only later when I got into And the name synchrotron radiation, we designed ourselves, so to say, that didn't exist at all before we wrote this paper.
I see.
But although I had not understood the the subjects very well when I was at this, I mean, they were short discussions and just during receptions and so.
Right.
I did remember enough of it to to think of the implications in connection with this large polarization. And so it was only when we got these polarization observations that I, for the first time, started to think seriously about what they had told me in the Soviet Union. And then I studied these papers, by the theoretical papers. But if I hadn't been in the Soviet Union and had not heard these vague reports during receptions, I would not, I would never have got any idea about
it. Once you began thinking about this synchrotron radiation, was it clear to you that that's what was happening in the Crab Nebula? You know, this idea was must be right.
Yes. You know. Yeah.
What about for the galactic background? Could you make that jump and say that, well, that must be synchrotron also? Or
yes, that we did very much later, and that was much more difficult. I mean, in the radio waves.
To actually measure the polarization.
That was actually measured by Seeger and others, but that was rather later.
Right, but what I'm asking you, though, in terms of what you were thinking, once you learned about the synchrotron mechanism, did you seem to you like this was the best candidate for the galactic background also?
Yes, but it was not at all certain that that could be measured properly and that it would not be depolarized and so on. So
you're talking about some actual observational proof, or
well, what I'm saying is not so much the polarization aspect, but just what your feelings were on the nature of the galactic background. I mean, as soon as you learned about synchrotron, did you just flip over and say, "Well, the galactic background"?
Oh yes, that at the same time.
Okay,
I realized quite clearly. Yes.
And was that the general case amongst radio astronomers? Do you feel or did they?
I suppose so. After it became clear that the background radiation was only partly thermal and had partly a quite steep spectrum, it must have been generally realized, and that it.
There was no good competing. There was no good competing theory. I don't believe.
No,
was it? Well, anyway, I interrupted you. So you measured the polarization here, and you also got some very nice plates from Bada.
Yes, and a year after, we went to it was the year of the IAU meeting in Ireland. We went to Cosmic Ray Symposium in Mexico, and there they were terribly interested, of course, in these measurements. And after that I went on to Pasadena and talked to Bader about it.
I see.
And he had just the day after I arrived, I think, he went to Palomar. He had a few nights in Palomar and immediately took these pictures. And they were really striking.
Which were then eventually analyzed by...
And then I became interested in the general problem of the Crab Nebula and in the central star of it and the filaments, moving filaments about which Bader had told me in the central part.
Well, speaking of that central star, here you mention that it has been suggested by Bada and Minkowski that the south receding component is the remnant of the supernova. Did you ever consider
making special observations of this star, or did you feel like there was not much that could be done?
Oh yes, but apparently at that time they couldn't do much about it. They had their best spectra didn't show much, and so.
Okay.
Because they were capable, sufficiently capable observers to have done what they could.
Okay, let's see what else we have here. The expanding arm with Rachor at the Paris Symposium, and then in the next couple years, also with von Worden in 57. Can you tell me about those observations? That was with the Dwingelow dish,
right,
was it not?
Yes.
And was that a complete surprise, or did you expect that there might be activity in our nucleus?
Not at all, no. So I didn't expect it at all. So it was an entire surprise. And I don't know whether you have got a reprint of our article on the in the compte rendu of the Paris Academy.
I do have a copy of that.
You
yes.
have a copy.
Yeah,
of
Hugo
that.
Gave me one.
Oh yes, this one.
Right.
Oh yeah. No, that was an entire surprise, and to everybody, and because we thought from the first that this was something that was really expanding and was due to activity in the nucleus. Later on, I began to doubt that again, or to feel less certain about it.
You're talking now in the last 10 years.
Yeah,
yeah, right. But at that time, you were quite clear that it was expanding.
It was expanding, certainly, but we always felt that we couldn't exclude the possibility that it was due to some to the fact that the dynamics of the galaxy in this inner region might be more complicated than we had considered so far. That you would have asymmetries like bar structure or so in the mass distribution that could account for it. But so that idea has been existing for all these years since this discovery, that it's it might be both things. It might be something that had been expelled, or it might be dynamical, the feature. And for the 3 kiloparsec arm, I'm not at all sure at the moment which is the right interpretation. Since then, of course, many other expanding features have been found closer to the center, say within 1 kiloparsec of the center.
Right. But that was not known at that time.
That was not known at that time. Well, not at that time, but rather soon after. We of course took this up right away and looked at the profiles near the galactic center in a more extensive way, and found that there must also be matter behind the center expanding away from the center, which was not observed in the Sagittarius A. So this subject developed right away, so to say, from the 3 kiloparsec arm to a wider subject.
Right. Well, you mentioned the absorption. I don't think that you were ever an author on those papers. That was Mueller.
Which one?
The absorption of the hydrogen, by the hydrogen, of various continuum sources, Sagittarius, Cassiopeia.
Well, Sagittarius A, of course, in this 3 kiloparsec arm.
Right.
But for the rest, I never worked on it specifically.
Right. Did that give you any new insights into the interstellar medium, would you say?
Not so very much. I mean, of course, it gave some insight into the detailed structure of the interstellar medium that must be quite discrete clouds of considerable optical thickness and small line small velocity widths and so on. But for the large scale structure of the galaxy and dynamics, it did not yield any very new insights.
What about the possibility of measuring distances through seeing whether various arms?
Yeah, no, that of course is an important thing.
But I guess that could only come later when there was more sensitivity, so you could look at these. Mm-hmm. In the 50s, you could only look at the very few biggest sources.
Well, there was an early paper by Miller on absorption, in which he found absorption in the Cassiopeia source, for instance, and that was already gave some information on the distance of Cas A.
But right. Well, the NRL group also.
Me?
The NRL group also made such measurements, and
yes,
they had a battle with Minkowski, which you may remember, about the distance.
Mm-hmm.
About Sagittarius A, was it always? What was your opinion as to whether or not it was at the galactic center? Whether or not Sagittarius A was at the galactic center? There was some.
So far as I remember, I've never doubted it.
There was some controversy, though, was there not? Maybe not in your mind. It was always. Okay. Well,
and I don't even doubt it now, although some people still doubt it at the present moment. Whether it's the exact center.
Right,
The very compact source is the exact center.
Right. Well, if I could just ask you about your memories of a few key meetings.
Of who?
A few key meetings. In Rome in 1952 was the first time, I believe, that radio astronomy results were presented at an IAU meeting. And
probably, yes. And I just looked at the reports of this meeting, and I saw that in the report of Commission 33 on galactic structure, there was no mention of it. Although I was president of that committee at the time. But then I mentioned in the beginning of this report that I did not consider any papers after 1948 or so.
Oh, I see.
But in the report on interstellar matter by Struve, Commission 34, there was a brief mention of it, so just two paragraphs on that page.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also, I believe that the announcement of the identification of Cygnus A was given at that meeting. Do you remember that?
I don't remember, but that's very likely. Yes.
What about the Jodrell Bank Symposium in 1955? Do you have any specific memories about what the important issues were that were discussed at that meeting? Or
no, that of course was came at a time when our general survey of the spiral structure of the galaxy had been completed more or less, and that was reported on, but I don't remember any very special things that, because the expanding arms had not yet been discovered at that time, and
right.
It would have been just a report on the H1 distribution and motion in the galaxy.
Yeah, well, Hart Westerhout has told me about hauling this huge model.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a big
yes, that was prepared for that meeting. That is right. True. That is true. Mm.
And also for the Dublin IAU meeting,
which came right after.
Right.
But that was, of course, also the time when I myself was deeply interested in the Crab Nebula.
This was the main thing that you were talking about then.
At that time, that was was foremost in my mind. I'm sure.
Well, moving on to the Paris Symposium in 1958, where you did talk about the 3 kiloparsec expanding arm, but it seems to me that that was an important meeting in that it was sort of a dividing line between when radio astronomy was a rather small group of people who could all get together And then later on, it very soon became sort of big science.
Right. It was a very nice meeting. especially since it was limited, the attendance was limited, and so one could really discuss things. And one could get a fine general survey of the whole subject of radio astronomy. And that was the last time.
Right, in one week you could do that.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, just a couple last questions of a general nature. Oh, I'm sorry, there's one more specific question. This is to do with the Benelux Cross, which we did discuss in the last interview. And I've found quite a bit in the archive about it. But I was wondering, there were several different project leaders, so to speak. Christensen, Hergbaum, Ericsson at various stages. Do you think that hurt the project in terms of continuity? Or do you think that things would have gone along at about the same speed if you'd had one person throughout that time?
It would have been much better, but if we had had one person. But there was a problem of finding one. We would certainly have been extremely happy if if Christensen could have remained for a longer time, and but he had his obligations in Australia and his family to think of. But certainly the changes in the technical staff and direction have been a great disadvantage. But that was not the only problem. The second problem, which we discussed, I think, before, was the cooperation with the Belgians, and it did not develop in the way we had hoped it would develop.
Well, I found the minutes of the meetings of the...
Well, that's quite a lot to look through.
Right. Which give a pretty good picture how it developed, although I'm sure there's even more than that. Okay, a couple of general questions to close. What would you say are the fundamental ways in which radio astronomy has changed astronomy, especially through about 1960?
Well, that's a big question. what do you want me to say?
Is it simply that it's a new wavelength region? Is it because it has made it into a violent universe?
I would say in the first place the possibility that radio astronomy offered to penetrate to larger distances and could be reached before. Now you may say, of course, that later on the discovery of the radio quiet quasars has shown that we might have penetrated quite as far by optical means.
But they were discovered through radio astronomy.
So otherwise we would never have found these things. So that, I think, is probably the most important influence that radio astronomy has had on astronomy at large. Mm-hmm. And the second point was, as you said already, the discovery that very much in the universe is of an explosive nature, and uh, because before the advent of radio astronomy, this had not at all been realized by astronomers. I mean, they knew there were supernovae and novae, but those were not considered as something that was an essential feature of the universe. I mean, there were things that concerned individual stars, but that that explosion phenomena would become of such prime importance as they are now in quasars and in general nuclei of galaxies has certainly been brought about largely through radio astronomical methods, although of course Seyfert galaxies were known and were discovered optically, and they, as we know now, are very closely related to the more violent things like quasars. But before radio astronomy came to the foreground, these were again considered more like rather special objects, mm-hmm. and that but that this explosive nature would be such an important element of the universe is has only come to be realized through radio astronomy, I think. Mm-hmm.
What about in the way astronomy is done? In the way that astronomy is done, do you think that radio astronomers have had a fundamental influence on the way observations are done, the way instruments are built?
Yes. Again, especially in these last few years. I mean, of course, optical observers have begun to use methods that one might say were borrowed from radio astronomy, mm-hmm. and certainly the coming of radio physicists into the picture has had a large influence also on the development of instrumentation in other wavelengths, and in optical wavelengths in particular.
Okay, one final question. You, of course, have always been very much interested in both radio and optical results, as well as the theories.
And infrared.
And infrared. X-ray. I'm talking about before 1960. However, most people at that time were either in one field or the other field, I think it's fair to say.
Quite wrongly, I think.
Quite wrongly?
Quite wrongly, I think.
Okay, right. No. But did you consider yourself a bridge between these two? Were you trying to convince people that they should get together?
No, I've never been very much of a preacher in that way. No, to me it was entirely natural that you should look at all possibilities that could further the insight into the problems in which you were interested in. If something offered itself at another kind of wavelength, it was only too natural to to look at that also.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
That ends the follow-up interview with Jan Oort on 6 September 1978 at his office in Leiden.